From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
That's a very important part of being human. You have to be able to sit back and analyse your failures. And it just seems that in the teenage years, you're learning that skill, but teenagers, well, unfortunately, in a way, perhaps they get too good at it.
Biologist David Bainbridge on the perils and pleasures of the teenage years in just a moment. This hour, teen angst. Why one literary critic isn't so sure that Twilight novels are good for teenage girls.
He just loves her and he's going to give her everything she wants materially and emotionally just because he loves her.
Also, comic Eugene Merman on the life and times of a teenage nerd and the secrets we wouldn't tell anyone. Shared on the blog Post Secret.
Whenever I finish a good book, I eat the last page.
Anyone who's got one knows it. Teenagers are different than adults. Their enthusiasm, mood swings, and navel-gazing are legendary. It turns out there's a good reason for that. According to biologist and science writer David Bainbridge, their brains are just about exploding, in a good way. Bainbridge is the author of the book Teenagers and Natural History. He told Steve Paulson that a prolonged adolescence is unique to humans and one of our greatest evolutionary advantages.
I think they're unique in human life. I think many of us knew that, but they're also unique in the whole scheme of things. One of the things that fascinated me about teenagers, you look in other animals, and they don't really seem to go through the same process. They do go through a juvenile stage, but the teenagers in humans, they're so fascinating because they're just this, I describe them, sort of constellation of events that all sort of link together and make this strange thing, which is a teenager. And obviously there's all the changes you'd expect, all the changes of puberty and the things that make boys and girls different. But there are lots of other things going on in there. There are huge changes going on in the brain and in human psychology, language changes. Obviously there's the start of sex and romantic relationships. There's just really so much going on. One of the weird things that sets us apart from other animals is we have this very dramatic adolescent growth spurt as well, which you don't really see so much in other creatures. So they're really unique in the animal kingdom.
Well, what's so fascinating about your perspective on the teenage years is that you say they are critical to our success as a species, whereas I think most of us, at least most adults, look back at that time as that's just something you want to get through to get to the other side.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because since I've been talking to people, since the book came out, half the adults I talked to say, oh, being a teenager was terrible. And the other half, like me, it was one of the best times of their life. They had a great time. There's really two lines of thinking that make us think that they are absolutely crucial. The first is really, it is circumstantial evidence, but it comes from the fossil record, which is that over the last sort of few years, we've actually been able to work out how old people were at different stages when they died and formed fossils over the last few million years. And effectively what we do is it's not that similar from working out how old a tree is. If you take a tooth, a human tooth, and you saw little sections through it, look at it under polarized light, you can see little growth rings. And those growth rings, each of those corresponds to a certain number of days. So you can work out how old people were when they reached maturity. And so from that, we think that people probably used to be mature when they're about 9 or 10, and then suddenly it jumped to about 18 or 20. And that occurred between 300,000 to 500,000 years ago. And so that was really when the first numerical teenagers occurred, the first humans who, you know, were still immature in their second decade. And almost immediately after that, the human brain made its final great leap to Homo sapiens size. I was, for some reason, I always describe brains in terms of oranges. Australopithecus had a one orange brain and Homo erectus had a two orange brain. And soon after we invented or we evolved teenagers, we leapt up to the three orange brain, which really is the same as what we have today.
That's fascinating. You're saying that we could not become the human beings that we are today without that long period of adolescence. I mean, specifically those teenage years.
Well, yeah, that's obviously the circumstantial fossil evidence. But if you actually look at what goes on in teenagers, and this is another thing we've only been able to do quite recently, is obviously now we can do brain scans, magnetic resonance imaging scans of living human people without doing them any damage. We needed to invent that to be able to look at the next stage of the story. But also, of course, the experiments take about 10 years if you want to follow individual teenagers through their teenage years. And when you do that, you find that this second decade of life, which humans have sort of tacked on fairly recently, there are lots of things going on, but there's very, very spectacular restructuring of the brain taking place. The brain actually gets smaller between the ages of 12 and 20, and yet just think of all the things you can do at 20 that you can't do when you're 12. So many of the things we learn when we're teenagers and pathways that we lay down, they really are the things that really make us uniquely human. I mean, admittedly, you can talk and you can walk on two legs by the time you're 12, which are obviously very important human characteristics. But so many of the other things, like the very complex language we use, our ability to handle abstract concepts and things like that, planning, long-term goals, all that comes when you're a teenager. And it seems to tie in, we're now beginning to tie this in, with changes that are actually going on in the brain, physical changes that you can see different bits growing during the teenage years.
Do you see the teenage years as basically preparation to become an adult? Is it the training ground to learn what we're going to do for the rest of our lives? I mean, if that were to happen too fast, we wouldn't be as smart in the end?
I think it does. Partly it just takes a long time because of the sheer size and complexity of the human brain and what it has to do. When I first started out in biology and doing research, I was working on animals, and I always had this sort of wishy-washy zoological liberalism about humans where I thought they were just another species. But the more I've worked on them, I've realized what utterly weird species we are. I mean, obviously we are just animals, but if you write a list of all the strange features of humans to do with the brain and reproduction, the way we move and language, we are extremely strange. And this huge brain we have, it's probably, I mean, most animals, you can calculate how big their brain would be from how big the animal would be. I mean, there's actually formulae to do this. And the human brain, by that argument, is about 4 or 5 times too big. So we've got this hugely powerful but potentially unstable brain. And I think it does just take that long to do all this reconfiguration. And then obviously there's the social aspect of human life as well, which is very, very complex, which you just kind of have to learn. And not that much of it is hardwired. I mean, I think the best example of that is at the beginning of a romantic relationship. The beginning of your first romantic relationship feels really strange because nothing, you just feel that nothing has prepared you for it. And I think the teenage years is just that sort of thing over and over again. And it just takes, well, 10 years or so.
Well, and there are also some very difficult aspects to these years. I mean, we all know that depression is a big problem for a lot of teenagers. There are a lot of teenage suicides. And I guess it raises questions about why those are such acute problems during this period.
There's two sides of this. I mean, you can either see, if you look at depression from the point of view of a mental illness, one of the most striking things about mental illnesses is most of them seem to start, whether they actually do start and have their roots, but they certainly seem to start in the teenage years, and that includes depression and anxiety and even schizophrenia often usually start in the teenage years. This is why it's so surprising that the early psychologists ignored teenagers so much. They're very interested in children and the effect they had on later adult behavior, but they largely ignored teenagers. That just seem to be a feature of mental illness in general. Depression itself is very, very interesting because there's certain things that happen that related to what we'd more generally call, what we colloquially call depression. One of the things you do learn is, remember I said that one of the things that humans learn to do that makes us so unusual is we analyze our own thought processes. And, you know, something goes wrong and you think about what went wrong and why it went wrong and how much it was related to you doing things wrong or whether it was just luck. And that's a very important part of being human. You have to be able to sit back and analyze your failures. And it just seems that in the teenage years, you're learning that skill, but teenagers, well, unfortunately, in a way, perhaps they get too good at it. And they spend lots of time thinking about their failures and seeing whether they reflect on themselves. And one thing that very noticeably happens in the teenage years is the incidence of clinical depression becomes much higher in girls than it is in boys.
We have to talk about two of the things that parents worry most about their teenagers, and that's sex and drugs. And you know, the temptation for a lot of parents is just to say, don't do it. Of course, teenagers seem obsessively interested in both those things. I mean, at least many of them are. Why do you think that is?
I think there is a slight difference here. I mean, obviously, teenagers don't have to do either sex or drugs, but obviously there's much more of an argument to say that sex is, at least to some extent, more natural teenage activity than drugs. I think the problem with sex is that by the time teenagers get to 20, well, of course, they won't be teenagers anymore, but by the time our children get to 20, we want them to be sort of sexually confident and mature. And yet we want them to somehow get there without actually having any sex, which is a bit of a contradiction in terms. I mean, there's lots and lots of studies of what people think about their first sexual contacts, and some of them are negative and some of them are positive. The first thing I'd say at the beginning is that actually when you're a teenager, people often worry about the risks of being a teenager and what can happen to them. I think there's one or two things that, as long as you avoid them, actually being a teenager is a chance to make mistakes and, you know, them not really ruin the rest of your life. But I think the two things, obviously, as far as sex is concerned, that teenagers do have to be careful of is either getting pregnant or contracting one of the sexually transmitted diseases that stays with you throughout your life. So I think one of the messages that is very important to get across to teenagers is barrier contraception. The reason why I think that's so important is because so much, I don't know about in the States, but over here, so much of what teenagers hear about in the media and at school about sex is negative. It's about the fear of catching various diseases or the fear of getting pregnant. And so much of what they hear about sex is negative. And yet, of course, deep in their little brains, their program, or their very big brains, as we've just heard, they're programmed to kind of expect sex to be fun and interesting and enjoyable, which is very lucky because that's not what they're hearing about from all around them.
So knowing what you do about teenagers, do you feel prepared as your own children start to enter this age?
This is a very interesting question. And ever since I've written this book, people say, well, you know, my children are 6, 8 and 11. And they say, well, do you think this will make it easier to have your own children? And I would so much love to be able to say very confidently, oh, yes, it'll be so much easier. I've written a book. It's bound to be easier. I have to say, in my heart of hearts, I suspect that it probably won't make any difference to what I actually do or how difficult I find it. I think occasionally they may do things and I'll think, oh, I know why you're doing that. But I don't think it'll fundamentally change the way I treat them. And this is one important thing I felt when I was writing the book, is that I wasn't writing a self-help book, because the thing I found when I looked at teenagers from a sort of zoological point of view is that to some extent they are just incompatible with adults. And that's inherently how they're... Well, perhaps we should phrase it the other way around. Adults are fundamentally incompatible with them.
David Bainbridge is the author of Teenagers: A Natural History. He spoke with Steve Paulson. If you'd like more information about today's show, stop by our website. It's ttbook.org. And leave us a comment while you're there. We always love to hear from you. Coming up later, writer Rebecca Walker on her difficult adolescence growing up with her celebrated mother.
She saw us and really talked about us as being more like sisters than mother and daughter.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Frank Warren might be the most trusted man in America. The founder of the blog Post Secret, Frank receives thousands of anonymous secrets via postcard every week. What started as a community art project has become a worldwide phenomenon, bringing in secrets ranging from embarrassing hobbies and adolescent longings for acceptance to the darkest memories of abuse, broken hearts, and betrayal. Today, Frank gives talks across the country, often speaking to teenagers in college and high school, who provide a lot of Frank's material. Here's a taste of the secrets he reads every day.
I don't want to admit I'm gay, because I still dream of being president.
I fake phone conversations when I don't want to talk to people in public.
While others pray at church, I bow my head and think about the TV shows I plan on watching.
I'm hoping to find secret love notes from you buried in my locker when I clean it out.
Today I made a list of fears. It wasn't as long as I thought it would be.
Frank told Anne Strangechamps why strangers are so willing to share their secrets with him.
I think the reasons are as varied as the secrets themselves. I think some people just want to share a funny story or write down something about a sexual taboo. But some of the postcards I get have artwork that is so painstakingly created, or the secret itself is worded like poetry or a song. And I think for them, there's a deeper reason. Maybe there's a search for a greater sense of authenticity or for grace or to try and forgive someone who's no longer in their life. I think also, too, the very act of sharing a secret on a postcard or with a friend is transformative, and it can change who you are.
Whenever I finish a good book, I eat the last page.
I used to pee into snowballs when I threw them at my friends.
As a kid, I thought I was half robot.
I'm an only child, and when I was 4, I had 7 imaginary playmates named Meanie, Mikkel, Miro, Poop, Peep, Hernoff, the gardener, and Mrs. Didi, retired school teacher. Now I'm 18 and going off to college. They're coming with me. I hope my roommate doesn't mind a crowd.
Do you think people would have the same response if you just started a website and encouraged people to email their secrets? I mean, how important is the postcard form?
There's something very meaningful about physically putting a secret on a postcard using your own words and then physically letting that go to somebody who you'll never meet.
We've been talking a lot in this hour about teenagers. And I know you compiled one whole book of postcards just from teenagers and college students. Did you notice anything about this particular age group's secrets?
Well, the second post-secret book is called My Secret, and it is a book composed primarily of secrets from people in high school and college. And when I composed that book and arranged the secrets, I was really trying to create the book that I wish I had had when I was in high school and feeling at times lonely, or in college and feeling at times without direction. And I think sometimes when those secrets can be shared as a collection and a young person looks through those postcards, it can allow them to feel maybe not that anyone else has their exact secret, but that other people have secrets too, and everyone is carrying a burden. And I think when you make that realization, it allows you to feel less alone with whatever it is your secret might be.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is most notoriously difficult about the teenage years are those feelings of alienation and isolation, you know, the feeling that you're the only one in the world with your particular feelings or your particular secret. Have you ever talked with kids who've read My Secret, and what have they said about it?
I have, and sometimes parents come to these talks too, and there'll be a mom and a daughter or a father and a son, and they'll talk about the experience of going through that book and how when you read dozens and sometimes hundreds of these authentic secrets, it allows you not just to feel more comfortable with your own, but actually to share them with the people who are close to you. And sometimes I hear stories of parents who will look through a child's diary to try and understand their inner life and the secrets of their son or daughter. But I always recommend, if you want to find out your child's secrets, the best way to do it is to tell them one of your own true secrets.
I'm afraid life won't be as exciting as I want it to be.
I trashed my parents' house when they were out of town so my mom would think I had friends.
I just wish someone could understand what I'm trying to say.
I just want to be part of something. Anything.
You're so evil. And I'm so I'll make it up to you someday.
Are there any particular secrets you've received from teenagers that have really stuck with you?
Yeah, I think the most poignant ones for me come from young people describing burdens or experiences that no young person should have to carry. And there's one in the second book, My Secret, that I received from a young girl who wrote, "When my friends joke around about how pissed off they are at their moms, I go along with them, But truly, I'd give my right arm just to have my mom still alive. And on the postcard, she had a picture of an arm, a right arm, next to an artificial limb.
You know, I think one of the hardest things for you must be reading all these people's secrets, receiving so much pain, and not really being able to reach out and, you know, give somebody a hug, tell them they're not alone.
Yeah, almost all the postcards come anonymously, so people, you know, it's impossible to contact the person even if I wanted to. But I think in a lot of ways, people don't want contact. They like the process of putting their secret on a card and then releasing it to someone who they'll never see and never hear back from, and they won't be judged. And I think when these postcards, almost each one with a piece of artwork on it, extraordinary artwork, come together as a collection, it allows us as a community to kind of get a peek into this hidden landscape of the parts of our lives that we don't talk about and don't share. And when it comes to young people especially, I think it can be very educational to parents and adults to see kind of this topography that adolescents are inhabiting on their own terms, in their own way, without adults around. And I think in this culture especially, with online possibilities, there's so much more that young people are able to do and go and see than previous generations. And I think PostSecret can act as kind of a window into that landscape.
Do you think there's something sad about your project?
Yeah, I do. But I also think there's something hopeful, and there's something sexual, and there's something optimistic and confusing. And I think every emotion that we can have, they're all reflected in the secrets I get. There's one secret I talk about. This was a postcard that came to my mailbox made out of a helium balloon that was deflated. And at the top it said, "It's a boy." And the person had written this secret on that. "When we decided to keep you, your life wasn't the only one saved." And so there's an example of a secret that really, I think, shows the hopeful nature of the project. At the same time, every time I travel, in fact, I've got this postcard with me right now. I always carry this postcard with me because it reminds me to always treat the people I meet during my travels with the respect and dignity that we all deserve. And like so many of the postcards, if you're really open to it, at the core, there's this kernel of experience or wisdom that I think we can learn from. This postcard has 6 rush stickers from an airport baggage handler on the face of it. And the secret reads, "You called me an idiot, so I sent your bags to the wrong destination. Whoops, I guess you were right."
Frank Warren is the founder of the blog PostSecret, and has compiled several books of secrets, including A Lifetime of Secrets and My Secret. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him. Most adolescents struggle to find their own identities. And as a Black, white, and Jewish teenager in the 80s, Rebecca Walker was no exception. The daughter of the famous African-American writer Alice Walker, Rebecca's teen years were spent moving between her white Jewish father's East Coast summer camps and her mother's West Coast ultra-liberal feminist world. With her mother, Rebecca had the kind of freedom most teenagers dream about. But for Rebecca, that freedom was mostly frightening and led to her eventual estrangement from her mother. She told Steve Paulson that writing about becoming a mother herself in her memoir Baby Love helped her sort through her feelings on feminism, raising a child, and growing up.
Finding my identity, so to speak, didn't really happen until my early 20s, mid-20s, I started to feel more comfortable with myself in my skin. And I think a lot of what was difficult is that I grew up moving back and forth between very different worlds. As a mixed race person whose parents met in the civil rights movement, one a nice Jewish lawyer from Brooklyn, my mother an African American from the Deep South. When they were married, it was wonderful, but when they divorced when I was 8, I ended up moving back and forth, and so I felt that I had multiple identities. I was sort of suburban, white, upper class on the East Coast, and Afro
artist on the West Coast. I mean, I really had to struggle with finding a stable ground.
And from what I've read, your parents had a very strange joint custody agreement where you would spend 2 years with one parent and then 2 years with the other parent.
Yes, very strange. I think they were thinking it was this perfect egalitarian plan. But yes, I had to move back and forth every 2 years. And what happened within that is that my parents actually moved even while I was with them, each of them in those 2 years. So I ended up going to a different school every year, which meant that my identity in a single location was not able to gel. So every time I moved, I actually moved into a different, not just racial or regional environment, but also socioeconomic environment and cultural environment. So I was constantly assessing what the dynamic was and what was expected of me in terms of being socially successful and morphing or changing to fit in, really.
Well, and your parents also gave you a lot of freedom as a teenager. You've written about how you started having sex at the age of 13. You took drugs as well. How do you look back on those years?
I look back on those years, especially as a mother now, with some sadness. You know, my parents were very busy working, and they had, I think my mother in particular, was a part of a larger movement that really saw encouraging young people's independence and autonomy as a good thing. And she saw us and really talked about us as being more like sisters than mother and daughter. And what that ideology yielded was a lot of expectation put on me to be much more mature than I actually was. So looking back now, I feel sadness that I had to perform this very mature self that didn't exist. And if I could do it all over again, obviously, I wouldn't have made the choices that I made as a result of being put in those positions. I think I was way too young to be asked to take care of myself so much.
Were there any ways in which all this freedom made you stronger?
Now, you know, as an adult, I think to be quite honest, I think I have often convinced myself that a lot of those freedoms yielded benefits. But now, as I really think about how much it takes to be a parent, and I look at my son, and I really try to recognize how much he needs, I'm not as convinced that it was ultimately a good thing.
What I find so striking about your story is, in many ways, you had the opposite life of what so many, let's say, suburban teenagers would love. I mean, they'd love to have their parents just basically leave them alone so they could stay out late, they could bring over boyfriends. Did you ever wish you had the opposite life when you were that age, a more average suburban American adolescence?
Well, you know, I think so many of us in my generation looked at the Brady Bunch and thought, oh, how wonderful. I mean, there was a kind of idealization of that family and a lot of television families in which problems were glossed over and potential conflicts were minimized. But I can't say that, I did. I wanted, a stable family. I wasn't enamored of the way I was growing up. No, I didn't think, oh, how cool, my best friend wants to invite all of her older friends over to drink beer and throw up off the side of the balcony and, you know, make out when my mother wasn't home. No, I didn't think that was cool. That felt like an awful lot of pressure for me because I really was aware that I was doing something wrong. I was aware that I didn't know how to say no to what was being presented. I was aware that I was uncomfortable because I wasn't really friends with the people that I was engaging with, because I had, in any given place, I'd only known people for, a few months, 6 or 7 months at the most, because I was constantly moving. So there was a lot of stress involved in that life. So no, I can't say that I enjoyed the level of freedom that I was given, I actually felt a tremendous dis-ease with what was going on.
Hmm. Your mother is, of course, Alice Walker, the famous writer and feminist icon. And in recent years, you have written about how you've come to question some of her feminist principles. Do you think she was misguided in the way she raised you?
Well, I think she was really, you know, trying to do the best she could. And I think that feminism at that point was about empowering girls and young women to feel confident sexually, to be more autonomous and independent. And so I think that she was following that program. And yes, I think that looking back, that agenda or that point of view was not the healthiest point of view for me as a young girl. And I know many of my peers who were raised similarly had the same kinds of experiences and feel similarly now. That this idea that young women and girls had been coddled and overprotected, and that if just given the right information that they would be able to be fully realized or fully responsible or, you know, strong, you know, Amazons in training. But the reality was that there was not quite an understanding of what we needed psychologically that transcended ideology. You know, ideology, it can only get you so far, but the human needs of psycho-emotional development are the same, no matter what ideological background you come from. And so to miss that understanding is to put your child, I think, in a very difficult situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then a few years ago, you yourself became a mother, and you've written about how that whole experience has changed the relationship with your mother. Can you tell me what happened when you first told your mother that you were pregnant?
Well, yes. My mother and I had a lot of differing opinions about motherhood. But I think what a lot of people don't realize about that book is that the real breakdown in that book, you know, the real breakdown in my relationship with my mother is a result of the memoir that I wrote, Black, White, and Jewish, about growing up and all the things that we were just talking about. So the book about being left alone and the book about all of the sexual exploration and the doing drugs and the fact that I wrote about that was very upsetting to her. And so we ended up having a real break in our relationship while I was pregnant about her feelings about my writing that book.
Do you have any contact with your mother now?
No, we have no contact at all, no.
Wow. What do you think is the most important feminist message you'll try to pass on to your son?
There are several. I think the most important is that there's no right way to be a man, believe it or not. I think, you know, my third book, What Makes a Man, is all about redefining masculinity. And that book was a very feminist book in that I realized that in order for women to be loved and appreciated and understood at the level that they deserve and need, that men would also have to be allowed to evolve out of a kind of, you know, warrior, protector, provider, emotionally stoic way of being. And so, you know, I really want to try to make room for him to be a man who is integrated, who doesn't need to be dominant or in control at all times, who doesn't feel he needs to self-sacrifice in order to be a good man. I want him to have choices and options and to be able to be creative and to be loving and not be thought of as weak, you know. I think that's one of the most important contributions I can make to him as a mother and as someone who has grown up within this language of feminism.
Rebecca Walker is the author of the memoirs Baby Love and Black, White, and Jewish, Autobiography of a Changing Self. She spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up later, why teenage girls are nuts about Twilight, for better or worse. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Here's comic Eugene Merman on The Birth of the Nerd.
I was in high school and stuff. I was like a big nerd, you would say. Like, I was a big nerd. But I wasn't the kind of nerd that did well in school or excelled in classes or got good grades. I was just more of just a douchebag, I guess you would say. But I also think that the people probably who were the first nerds, like the first true nerds, were probably alchemists. And knights, I bet, would just go into their laboratories with their lances and just knock over beakers and just be like, "Hey, wizard, nah, nah, nah." And I'll just be like, "I'm not a wizard. I'm an alchemist. I'm a real scientist trying to make this candy into karate." Or whatever alchemists did that was more reasonable.
Today, Eugene Merman has a thriving career as an indie comic who's appeared on Conan O'Brien, Comedy Central, and the hit HBO series Flight of the Conchords. Lately, he's been doing the rounds as the author of the outlandish self-help send-up called The Will to Whatevs. He says school was hell for him.
It was horrible. I mean, it's horrible for everybody. I mean, my thing was that I was an immigrant from Russia and it was the Cold War. And then I was also a weirdo. So it was really horrible at all fronts until maybe around 11th grade.
So you're telling me you weren't hanging around with the jocks and the cheerleaders?
No, I wasn't. I was also like almost beyond normal weird. Like it wasn't like, oh, he's goth. Like I think people thought I worshipped Satan or something. It didn't make any sense. And I hate Satan. I was more of a social pariah. Like, I can't describe it. Like, people would literally pull over their cars and point and go, "Hey, there goes Eugene." It's just the weirdest thing.
Somewhere I read that you were kind of hated in school, that even some of your friends have to pretend not to like you. What was that all about?
Oh, that's true. In elementary school, I'm now friends, of course, with this person, but a friend of mine in elementary school, it was so difficult to be my friend because there was so much venom towards me that she pretended to be mad at me so that we'd stop being friends. And that lasted about 5 years. And then in like 11th grade or something, we became friends again. And she lives in Brooklyn now and we're very good friends.
What is it, do you think? What is it about school? I mean, you write that school shapes who you become. Why is that so much true, you think?
It would be funny if school had no effect on people and was a massive waste of time. I think that school...
Well, there are people who think that, but that's another issue.
I mean, we all have to be able to read and write so we can ask each other out, basically, in letter format. I think that's, you know, what's sort of crazy is how sort of vicious school is. I mean, when you basically leave school and college, you know, people are mean, but it's not like a constant, you know, people don't constantly come up to you and say horrible things until you cry. And it's interesting that school is a place where that can happen.
Is this sort of why you became a comedian?
I mean, the 80s were a time of, you know, the boom of stand-up comedy. I mean, it was on television all the time. I adored it. I mean, I had, you know, I think as of fifth or sixth grade, I had endless Bill Cosby tapes and Emo Phillips and Bob Goldthwait. You know, I would listen to this stuff all the time. So I sort of fell in love with it. And I think at some point it occurred to me that that's a profession, that you don't have to go into computers. You can do something. You know, I found my whole notebook from all of school, the folder that they give you at the end. And in it, I had written, you know, and I don't know what grade, like seventh or eighth grade, that I wanted to be, you know, a comedian.
Well, a lot of people talk about how high school turned them into comedians because they had to find a way to laugh because there wasn't much else to laugh at. Is that true for you?
Yeah. I mean, certainly, I think that at some point, you know, what was weird about me turned into humor, I guess. I think at some point I went from being just a really strange person to a comedian.
There's a bit of advice in the book that I thought was interesting. You said you should buy the most expensive jeans you can afford, and this will help?
Yes, in a 200-mile radius, I believe. Yeah, I think that, you know, people will really take notice of your extremely expensive jeans, and then everyone will fall in love with you. I mean, that's something to maybe do. Was that for high school or junior high?
You know, I can't remember. It had to do with Ashton Kutcher, though.
Yes, it did have to do with claiming that your father was the president of Ashton Kutcher, because everyone will be impressed by that.
Yeah.
That would be maybe one of the things to not do that I suggest.
If a parent were to ask you, and there are a lot of parents who have teens who are suffering, if a parent asks you what they need to know, what can you tell them?
If a parent asks me what they need to know about raising a child or about their sad child, what do they want to know?
Well, let's pick their sad child first. They have a sad child. What do you say to them? Wait?
I would definitely recommend waiting. Maybe buy them night vision goggles so that they can just go out explore in the dead of winter. That's one solution.
I like the night vision goggles. That's good.
It's fun. Basically, what I'm saying is figure out a way for them to have fun and do something enjoyable. And night vision goggles are really fun. I just bought some at Toys R Us, to tell you the truth.
Eugene Merman is a comedian and author of the book, The Will to Whatevs. Unless you've been living under a rock, it's been impossible to miss the adoration lavished on Stephanie Meyer's teen vampire series, Twilight. The fans are mostly teenage girls, but sometimes older women as well, who love the books for their riveting tale of Bella, the human girl, and Edward, her vampire suitor.
My family, we're different from others of our kind. We only hunt animals. We learn to control our thirst. But it's you, your scent. It's like a drug to me. You're like my own personal brand of heroin.
Why did you hate me so much when we met?
I did. Only for making me want you so badly. I still don't know if I can control myself.
A clip from the movie Twilight. Salon's literary critic Laura Miller isn't so thrilled with the books or their popularity with young women. She told Anne Strangechamps that the books present a fantasy that's a little too appealing.
I think that it offers women, and especially young women, but not necessarily young women, a kind of a fantasy of this supernaturally strong, perfect, powerful, rich male who will cherish and protect them through all of the kind of things that can happen to you in life, but who will have an ability to protect them that is so much in excess of any actual man that it's like a superpowered throwback to the old idea of what it is to be a woman, which is to be, you know, sort of under the wing of a man, to be protected and cared for and sort of sheltered as you sort of move through all of the stages of life. And I think that it's pretty hard to find that situation anymore, if it ever was a very real situation. And one of the reasons why you see it coming in the form of this vampire is that, to a certain degree, Prince Charming is something that women really know by now as a mythological creature. And so in order to sort of give a nod to the fact that it is really a pure fantasy, it comes in the form of this supernatural creature who doesn't, you know, who we all know doesn't really exist. Mm.
Are you saying that this is basically a throwback to an old-fashioned romance underneath modern fantasy veneer? That
yes,
maybe,
absolutely.
Maybe underneath the vampire or the werewolf, it's just Kathy and Heathcliff or Jane and Mr. Rochester all over again?
Yeah, I mean, although, you know, Kathy and Heathcliff and Jane and Mr. Rochester had complex relationships. And, you know, the other thing about Twilight is it's very, very simple. The heroine has almost nothing to recommend her. Well, really, she has nothing to recommend her. She's
Let's
a
not
person,
miss words.
Yeah. She is a person of almost no personality. And her boyfriend isn't a whole lot better. I mean, from a literary point of view, they're completely uninteresting as characters, which is not something I would ever say about Cathy and Heathcliff or Jane Eyre and Mr. Rochester. They're sort of stripped down to the basics of the romantic heroine and hero. She is, you know, sort of pretty and kind of vulnerable and inexperienced. And he is older, a lot older, although he still looks young and beautiful. And he's very rich and he's super strong and he's super fast and, you know, he can do everything. You know, he's a classical musician. He's a really good driver. He has like 4 hot cars. You know, he's completely unrealistic. But underneath it all, I mean, or not even underneath it all, really, he's just an exaggerated form of the romantic hero who was always older and more worldly and more experienced than the heroine and who is sort of won over by some quality of hers that of wonderfulness that often is really hard for any person outside of the hero to see. I mean, it's very hard to see why Bella appeals to him. You know, she's not especially smart or clever or funny or original, even though he claims that she is.
Well, Stephanie Meyer, the author, has said that she deliberately made Bella a normal girl. So she doesn't go to a fancy private school. She's not a martial arts expert in her spare time.
Yeah.
She doesn't have secret wizard powers. She's not the long-lost heir to a magical kingdom. She's just normal. Is that part of her appeal?
Well, I think that my impression is, and from the friends I've talked to who have teenage girls, teenage daughters, you know, the readers don't really care very much about her. It's not so much about looking at her and saying, oh, that's me, I understand her, she has my inner life, which is how maybe you might feel about someone like Jane Eyre, who has a very strong personality despite her mousy exterior. Bella is very, very bland. She's like a blank screen that the reader can project herself onto. But I don't think that the readers have any particular fondness for her. What they care about is Edward and his sort of extended family of beautiful, glamorous vampire relatives. The fact that he's a blood-sucking undead vampire is sort of immaterial to his prince charmingness. He comes and he chooses her and he makes her into a princess. Just by choosing her. It's not something that she really has to earn by anything that she does or is. It's just by being chosen by him. So, yes, I think it's a very soothing fantasy because the man is completely immune to the kinds of insecurities and stresses that are leveled against not just teenage boys, but just any sort of ordinary human man.
Except at the same time, I wonder whether there isn't something really positive about this series for girls who today, teenage girls are, you said it's not real, but they've got more than enough reality in their lives. You know, they've got Facebook and guys who are wanting to have oral sex with them from 8th grade on, and every possible form of sexual activity can be seen online or on TV. Maybe it's a really good thing for them to have a book that's just about pure romance.
Well, you know, to say that something is just a fantasy is not to say that it's a bad thing. I mean, the thing about fantasy is not that it's wrong, even if the things that we fantasize about are things that we would never actually want to have happen to us. The issue with fantasy is not that to have fantasy is bad. It's to know the difference between fantasy and reality. Now, if you decided that you could never really be happy unless you had a man who was the equivalent of Edward, then you would be in trouble. And I think that's been an issue with the culture of romance and romantic love for centuries, that it's very easy for women to allow themselves to be persuaded that this is something that they should expect from life, you know, that life is going to be like a fairy tale. That's why we say it's a fairy tale, because we're reminding ourselves that although we really enjoy this fantasy and it is a nice escape, if we start to expect our lives to be like our fantasies, then we are setting ourselves up for a lot of suffering. The crucial thing is not to not have fantasies or to have a certain kind of fantasy. The crucial thing is to know the difference between fantasy and real life.
You're starting to make me feel sorry for all those teenage boys out there who are not super strong, super fast, 104 years old, and keep Maseratis in the garage.
Yeah, I think that's the real question is, you know, we could worry that all these teenage girls are reading this book with this heroine who's kind of just so, you know, to an adult, just such a dull sort of person. Or you could worry that, you know, the boyfriend, as many of the sort of librarians and teachers that I've corresponded with since I wrote about these books, they're worried that Edward is kind of a creepy stalker, you know, like he's so protective, he won't let Bella do anything. He comes and watches her while she's asleep and she doesn't know. I mean, he's always like kind of watching her and telling her what to do and kind of engineering her life, you know. He's telling her that she has to go to college, and, you know, he kind of sets it up so that she can get into an Ivy League college if she wants. I mean, in a certain way, you are so right. You know, he is alleviating all of the anxieties that a teenage girl is likely to have, that she has to be smart because Belle's not good in school, that she has to be beautiful, she's not especially pretty, that she has to be good at anything. You know, he just loves her, and he's going to give her everything she wants materially and emotionally, just because he loves her. And so all of the kind of pressures that a teenage girl might feel to be an exceptional person is removed. And, you know, no wonder that that feels like such a cozy, wonderful place to be. But the real question is, do those teenage girls then transfer those desires to the actual boys and men when they get older in their lives? And I don't think we really know that. I mean, maybe they just read it and they go, oh, this is just, you know, this is just a fun thing, a fantasy that I have. But I know that, you know, in my actual life, I'm never going to have a relationship like this. And that even if I had it, it would probably be insufferable because he's so controlling. I think that's what a lot of people are worried about, is whether they will be able to make that separation or not.
Laura Miller is a literary critic at Salon.com and the author of The Magician's Book. She spoke with Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 38A, Teen Angst. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Veronica Rickert and Madeline Mahan, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strangechamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Doug Gordon. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.